So I thought maybe I could talk about loving kindness practice a little bit now, and then we get a chance to do some, and then come back and have questions. And first do it walking and then sitting, and then have questions. And then this afternoon I'll go into the Eightfold Path, which is the last of the Four Noble Truths. So loving kindness is the common translation, as many of you know, of the word metta, M-E-T-T-A, in Pali. A more literal translation of the word is friendship. So metta is about developing the art of friendship for oneself, and this means all aspects of oneself, and ultimately for all of life, the boundlessness of life. This is the art or the cultivation of a quality which is said to be innate to our being as a capacity. One of the key teachings of the Buddha, you know, as we've talked about, is the universality of this kind of capacity. That no matter what we've gone through, no matter what we may yet go through, we have the potential to connect, to care, to have loving kindness, to have compassion. That potential may be covered over, but it is never, ever destroyed. And so when we practice, you know, it's not from coming from a place of kind of deficiency and dread, you know, like, oh, you know, everybody else can do it, but I can't do it. Or, you know, if I work really hard forever, maybe I will have a moment of loving kindness. But it's with a certain sense that there is, in fact, this capacity within. And that itself is a huge step. In another context, sometimes I tell the story about being with my friend Joseph Goldstein in Houston, Texas, where we were visiting a friend, and one day the three of us decided to go to a restaurant and order food, not there, not to eat there, but to take back to this friend's house. So we're hanging around in the restaurant after having placed our order and struck up a conversation with the young guy who was working behind the counter, and he started saying that he had never left Houston in his life and that his absolute dream was to someday get to Wyoming. And so Joseph said to him, well, what do you think you'll find in Wyoming? You know, what do you think will be there for you? And he started describing this sense of space, you know, not being confined, not being held in, just like so much space, so much openness, and like the clear sky and the brilliance and of the light and all that. So Joseph looked at him and said, there's an inner Wyoming too, you know. And the kid said, that's freaky. And he walked away, you know, so. It's not that easy, actually. This is a very important step to have, you know, you don't need full-blown confidence, but just to have a sense that we can be different, that we have this kind of potential, and to acknowledge it. It's much easier, really, in terms of our conditioning, to acknowledge what's wrong than to have some sense of, oh yeah, as a human being, with cognizance, with awareness, I have the ability to move out of these ruts, to discover things about myself, about life, about the world. So the belief is that we all have this capacity to connect, to care, to have a sense of compassion, and so on. And the practice is kind of cultivating it, nurturing it, nourishing it, helping it grow, giving it some space, actually, so that it can come forth, instead of being so overcome by all of the other things that we believe about ourselves, or, you know, we fear in life, and so on. So metta is loving kindness. Sometimes we translate that as love, and that of course works, except it's so very complicated a word. When we say love, we mean so many different things. Sometimes we really frankly mean a medium of exchange. I will love you as long as you love me in return, as long as you say so loudly. I will love you as long as the following 15 conditions are met. And I once used that example somewhere, and someone in the group called out, only 15? You know, so I said, okay, you know, I will love you as long as the following 50 conditions are met, whatever it is. You know, and it's not, you know, to heap scorn upon that state, but it's so fragile. It's like saying to oneself, I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. You know, so how long is that going to last? I will love you as long as I can control your response and your mood and your acknowledgement of my generosity and your ability to heal on the schedule I've laid out for you, and so on. So obviously it's so fragile a state, so brittle. It's quite different from what is meant by metta or loving kindness. So loving kindness as a body of teaching is joined with three other qualities. And together these four are known as the Brahma Viharas. Brahma meaning supreme or celestial, or one translation I heard of it that I liked a lot is the word best. Vihara meaning dwelling or abiding or home. So taken together, these four qualities are said to form our best home. And like any home, we're not there all the time, but it should be the place where when we return, we feel most ourselves, most authentic, most genuine, least pretentious. We're home. And that's a very important thing. You know, in teaching this particular practice, because it is a sort of a distinct methodology that's usually done along with awareness practices, in teaching this so much, I so often find people feeling kind of squeamish about it, you know, like, ooh, you know, if I were really to develop a loving heart, wouldn't that mean that I wouldn't protect myself, I wouldn't take a strong stand about anything, I'd let other people be hurt or abused, and I'd just kind of smile, you know, and not do anything about it. Or there's a certain sense of pretentiousness or phoniness that we can often associate with the sense of loving kindness, and certainly a sense of weakness or lack of discernment or lack of discrimination. And yet none of that is really true. We're talking about what is an enormous force for transforming ourselves and, I believe, for transforming this world. One of the books I wrote, it's called The Force of Kindness, and there's a title suggested by the publisher, which I was very happy about, because one of the things I was trying to say is that, you know, we can so often think of kindness as like a secondary virtue. You know, it's like if you can't be brilliant and you can't be wonderful and, you know, well, be kind, you know. It's like a little something. It's not great, but it's something, you know. But actually it is a force. It's a tremendous force in our own hearts in this world. And so when we practice loving kindness meditation, it has no element actually of being phony or put on or trying to hide what we're actually feeling and cover it over with a veneer of seeming loving kindness. It's a tremendous exploration and confrontation with our ideas about aloneness, about being ineffectual, about competition, about sorrow. There are many, many things that are uncovered. So the first of the Brahmaviharas is loving kindness itself, which as the art of friendship can also be understood as connection. We come to this realization of how connected we are in many different ways. One is just through wisdom. It's through seeing more clearly. And this is very interesting, you know, because this doesn't have to be sort of in a spiritual sense. It's just looking. We can see this through environmental awareness. We can see this through economics. We can see this through epidemiology. We can see this through science. You know, we are connected, like it or not. You know, we live in a world, as the Dalai Lama has said, where it used to be easy to say, well, what happens over there is going to stay over there. But it actually doesn't stay over there, ever. And now we live in a world where that is revealed to us in so many different ways. You know, so sometimes, like, sitting with people like you all, I like, we can do this now, you know, we'll just do a reflection for a few moments on how many people are involved in your being here in this room right now. Like, how many people gave you a book or talked to you about meditation or read you a poem or played you a piece of music? All these different influences and interactions and connections, you know. So let's bring them here for a moment. Whoever comes to mind. And sometimes I like to include all the people who've really, really hurt us. Not just the ones we find sort of annoying or irritating, but the ones whose actions have really brought us to an edge so that we said, I've got to find a different way. You know, I'm so caught. I've got to find another meaning of happiness, something like that. Because they are part of our being here too. And how many forms of life have been involved in the food that we've eaten so far today? If it was something from a crop, who planted that? Who harvested it? Who transported it? Who sold it to us? How many beings have been involved, how many forms of life in the clothes that we're wearing? Built this building, maintained this organization. You know, we live as though we each just appeared here, like, whoop, here I am. You know, but every moment of our lives is a complex web of interactions and influences and relationships and connections. This is the truth. It's not make-believe. So generally, you know, in trying to describe this, I often use this example from my friend Bob Thurman, who has a very New York kind of example. And interested, when I arrived at the airport, I saw the headline here in the paper about mass transit, so I thought that was interesting. But, you know, his story, which I quote so much, where he said, imagine you're on a subway and these Martians come and they zap the subway car so that those of you who are there in the subway car are going to be together forever. He says, what do? You know, if somebody's hungry, you feed them. Somebody's freaking out, you try to calm them down. Not because you necessarily like them or approve of them, but it's this like bone deep recognition. We're in this together. You know, that's the truth of things. And so the wiser we grow, the more we see clearly, the more awareness we can bring forth, this is what we actually see, is how interconnected we all are. And then the other major source, it is said, for the nurturing, the cultivation of the sense of loving kindness and compassion is actually, it's like taking a few risks with our attention, being willing to look at things consciously from different angles, to include where maybe we are used to excluding, to open where maybe we're used to being closed, to take the time to pay attention to somebody where maybe we're in a great big rush most of the time, ordinarily. To look at ourselves differently, to look at others differently. Not as a kind of forced way, you know, nothing contrived, nothing manufactured. But it's almost like playing with one's attention. Just being willing to change how we pay attention, who we pay attention to, and so on. So the first question is, what do we usually pay attention to? And here my favorite example is, you know, let's say you're the kind of person who at the end of the day sort of assesses yourself, like, how'd I do today? And let's just say you're the kind of person who tends to focus or even fixate on the negative. Like, that was a really stupid thing I said at lunch at that meeting. That was really, really stupid. And it's like all that you are and all that you will ever be is contained in that really stupid comment that you made. So there's just this sense of collapse, of fixation. So you could say almost like the perspective of loving kindness would almost be one of asking yourself, anything else happened today? You know, like, anything good happened today? Did I do anything good today? Not to make believe, you know, it's not like you're saying, oh, wasn't that a brilliant and witty thing I said at lunch? Maybe it was really stupid, you know, and there are consequences of that. But that's not all that we are. So what do we pay attention to? And are we willing to open beyond the narrow confines of habit just to see what it's like? And how do we pay attention? You know how often, well, we all know how often our attention is fragmented, it's scattered, it's divided. It's wonderful, you know, sitting here in front of the picture of the 17th Karmapa, and I hope many of you got to see him when he was here in Seattle. And his predecessor, the 16th Karmapa, was living in Sikkim when I was living in India in the 70s. And he was, as some of you may have known him as well, you know, he was extremely powerful, very eminent, an amazing presence with the 16th Karmapa. And one of my friends once went off to Sikkim to see him, and he came back and he said that the Karmapa greeted him as though his appearance were just about the most important thing that had ever happened to the Karmapa in his life, which I'm sure it was not. And he said that the Karmapa conveyed that impression not through pomp and circumstance and not through grandiose gestures, but by paying absolute, complete attention to him. So my friend said the subjective experience of that was one of feeling completely loved. And I was so moved when he said that, and a little chagrined too, because I thought about the many conversations that I have where I'm kind of listening and I'm kind of thinking about the next thing I need to do. And I mean, this was a long time ago in India. Now, you know, it would be like, well, I have to do that email, and what about the fax, and what about the phone call, and my cell phone, and then I have to check the messages here. And then, you know, it's so easy to barely be there. And it wouldn't take that much, actually, to gather our attention, to be there much more fully. So how do we pay attention? And what about all those beings? You know, we've already drawn a conclusion. We've already made a decision. And so we don't really listen. You know, it's like we've taken their file and put it in the folder and put it in the drawer, and they're going on and we're not really paying any attention at all. What if we could stop in recognition of that, and kind of pull out the file folder and open it up and listen? Maybe we'd have some very great surprises. And who do we pay attention to? How many beings do we encounter that we just ignore? We look right through. They are the other in some way. People, creatures. We're so divided. You know, it's like we live in this little bubble. And even though we interact, or even though we are connected in truth, we don't experience that because we are sort of in this bubble. So what would happen when we stop? and actually pay attention to somebody rather than looking right through them, rather than living, you know, according to our assumption, our bias, our presupposition. It's quite interesting. I was telling Helen and Rodney earlier that Joseph and I were teaching in New York City together not too long ago, and there's a local group like Sims here. There's a group called New York Insight, and this was a benefit for them, and they had rented this part of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, the Synod House, and so we were uptown and settling in, and in the first sitting, there were these huge, raucous shouts that started outside, and people were screaming and yelling, like, way to go, and you did it, and that's fabulous, you know, and very, very loud, and for, like, the whole sitting. And you could just feel, like, the irritation in the room, you know, like, you know, and I was thinking, why'd they rent this place? Why didn't they check out that there was, like, a basketball tournament going on outside, you know, like, this is really, you know, this is awful, and, you know, and you could just feel just this general agitation and irritation, and it was really, really loud. And people were like, and then it was time for walking meditation. I didn't get out of the building during the walking meditation, but a bunch of people did. And when they came back, I said, what's going on out there? And they said, oh, it's the AIDS walk. And the finish line is right outside here, you know? So there's 75,000 people, you know, streaming across the finish line. Everyone's screaming, yay, you did it, you know? And they were beaming, all these people. And all of a sudden I thought, wow, what a great thing to be listening to. And, you know, isn't that fabulous? And then we had another sitting and everyone was like so grateful, you know, for every sound. You think, well, look at that, you know. Sometimes we need to actually get a little more information, or we need to pay attention, or we need to, you know, really use the acuity of our awareness. You know, so none of this is about sentimentality or trying to pretend we like somebody when we really don't, but it's using the force of our awareness to actually connect. It doesn't mean we say yes to everything. It doesn't mean we're passive. It doesn't mean we don't try to, you know, take care of others and sometimes take very strong action. But the place from which we are doing it is one of acknowledging our connection. It's really paying attention, instead of just living in this world of assumption and separation. So loving kindness is the first of the Brahmaviharas. It's distinguished from attachment, which can look very much the same, but is really tremendously different. Attachment being more in that mode of wanting to be in control, having impatience, having expectation. All of these practices in some way are considered practices of generosity, not necessarily material generosity, but generosity of the spirit. And so for the loving kindness to be a freely given gift, it's distinguished from the force of attachment. Like, you know, may you be happy by tonight in the following 10 ways, and, you know, that's attachment. Whereas loving kindness is much more like, may you be happy. The second of the Brahmaviharas is compassion, which is defined as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. And the first part of that is seeing pain as pain. You know, seeing our own jealousy, our own fear, our own confusion as painful, not as bad and wrong and terrible and, you know, making us worthless people. But these are painful states. To be caught in them is painful. And so if we can sense that, then there can be a response of compassion. And just as we see that within ourselves, so too we see that around us. And here it's very confusing because compassion can seem to us to be awfully weak, and kind of meek and mild and sweet. And the first book I wrote was called Loving Kindness and is about this practice, and my great fear was that people were going to think of it as sweet. And sure enough, when the blurbs came back, two people used the word sweet in their blurbs, and they meant it in the most beautiful way. But we can so easily think of sweet as saccharine sweet and kind of gooey and phony, and it's not really like that at all. You know, to have compassion does not mean that we just succumb, that we give in. That, in fact, it means the opposite. There's a tremendous strength out of that caring. The trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. We are moved to go forward, to be with, to see if we can make a difference. And yet, it's considered different than the state that is often translated as sorrow or grief. It doesn't really mean the Western psychological sense of grief. Somebody just suggested they use the word despair, which is a sense of being like crushed by the suffering that we see, being overcome by the suffering that we see, because it's just common sense almost that, you know, if that's what happens, then there's nothing in us. There's not this sense of energy, of capacity to go forward, to try to make a difference. It's like when I spent a day at Walter Reed Hospital some months ago doing a program for the nurses, and someone gave me a tour of one of the wings before, and of course there's tremendous suffering everywhere. And the nurse giving me the tour said, you know, the nurses who can sustain their work here are the ones who really tune into the resilience of the human spirit. If you get lost in sorrow, you can't last. You know, and it's true. It's like if we're so depleted and we're so overcome and kind of broken, there's nothing in us, you know, to go forward, to sustain an effort, to really be present with some intense sorrow. And so it's confusing, it's very tricky, but they're really very different, these two states, compassion and, you could say, being overcome by suffering. You know, we, in doing these practices, we really make a tremendous exploration of these and really learn from within where the strength lies and what we need in terms of balance and so on. So compassion is the trembling or the quivering of our hearts in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's that movement toward, rather than calling it something else, recoiling, denying, covering it over, hating it, hating ourselves for not being able to heal the world in the moment. So it's quite distinct from that. And if compassion helps us open to suffering, the third Brahmavihara, sympathetic joy, helps us open to joy. So sympathetic joy is defined as the ability to rejoice in the happiness of others, rather than, you know, so commonly, to be honest, you know, we see somebody enjoying success or good fortune, and we think, ooh, you know, I would be happier if you had a little less going for you. You know? I mean, really, isn't it true? You know? Like, you don't have to lose everything, but, you know, if that light could just dim a bit, that would be better. So here, too, there's a lot of confrontation with certain assumptions. We're assuming that this person has everything and we have nothing. You know, and in that moment, that's how it feels. We're assuming that the state of things is going to last forever. You have what you have and will always have it, and I have nothing. You know, we're assuming that happiness is like a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less there's going to be for us. We're also assuming, I think, it's almost like the praise or the success or the accolade, whatever, is like floating around in the air. And the only reason it didn't land on us is because it landed on them. And if only it hadn't landed on them, definitely it would have landed on us. Absolutely, without a doubt. But does that make any sense? And I know many of you have heard me tell this story before, but my favorite story about it is I was teaching at IMS one year, and I was talking about sympathetic joy, and I said, okay, it's like this, you know, say you're in New York City and it's Sunday morning and you go by the New York Times and you open it up to the book review section and there's, you know, the bestseller list, and you notice that your friend's book got on the bestseller list, and you just get this kind of crummy feeling inside. Ooh. You know, it should have been my book, and it would have been my book if only theirs hadn't got on it. And by the most bizarre of coincidences, I had three friends sitting that retreat, all of whom had had books on the New York Times bestseller list, and they all came up to me after the talk and said, is that how you felt? On the New York Times bestseller list? And I had to say, no, definitely not. Which I didn't really. I really didn't. But of the of these four qualities, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and the last will be equanimity, sympathetic joy is often considered quite difficult. Not impossible, but it's challenging. And yet when we do cultivate it, it's such a huge freedom. You know, as the Dalai Lama said, you know, it only makes sense to cultivate happiness and the happiness of others, because then we increase our chances of happiness 6 billion to 1. And he said, those are very good odds. You know, and you think about that, you know, what would it be like not to just have this perpetual sense of like, oh no, they have too much, I don't have enough, I've got to, you know, if only, and, you know, and just to take delight, it would be such a huge thing. And we know the feeling, actually, of sympathetic joy, because we know what it's like when we receive it or we don't ourselves. You know, something good happens for you, and some people are so happy for you, and it feels like such an enormous gift. And other people, it's like, you can tell, you know, they are not that pleased that things are going well for you, and it feels so diminishing and hurtful. So even though it can be quite challenging, it is certainly within our capacity to nourish this quality, and we will get many huge benefits from that kind of freedom and that kind of delight. And then the last of the four Brahmaviharas is equanimity, which means it's sort of defined differently somewhat in different Buddhist traditions, but within the Theravada tradition of Burma and Thailand and so on, it's defined as a kind of balance of mind, which has an understanding that things are as they are. You know, and this, I think of equanimity in this sense as the articulation of wisdom. It's like the voice of wisdom, where we want someone to be happy, we do everything we can to help create the conditions of happiness for them, and it's not our universe to control. You can't make somebody do something else. We can't stop time. We can't hasten time. You know, it's a big, big picture of life where we might do everything we can do. And we also need a kind of balance, you know, so we don't fall into attachment, so we don't feel so overcome by suffering, so we don't, you know, lose perspective. So many times we do something to try to make a difference in this world, and it really is a seed. That's what it is. We don't know when it will grow, how quickly, how slowly. We do know that if we don't plant the seed, nothing's going to happen. But we can't make it all happen according to our timetable, according to our wishes. Life's very mysterious in that way. You know, there are lots of unfoldings, times we think things are going wrong and it turns out to be a good thing. And then, you know, There's so much movement and flow, and it's not chaotic or haphazard, but it's sort of beyond our capacity to really sense how things will unfold. Yet we get so impatient. You know, if we have some equanimity, it's like big picture mind. You know, I will do everything I can do without such a ferocity of attachment about getting results today. I finally got my t-shirt. You know, as many of you have heard me talk about this as well, when we first opened the Insight Meditation Society, within a month we received two letters that were remarkable for how they were addressed. The first, instead of being addressed to the Insight Meditation Society, was addressed to the Instant Meditation Society. And for a while that was my favorite. I used to look at it and think, what were they thinking, you know? But of course, that's how we are. Something doesn't happen instantly. It's not any good. And the second, which has been my favorite for many years, instead of being addressed to the Insight Meditation Society, was addressed to the Hindsight Meditation Society. And that I absolutely loved, you know. I thought, wow, that is so cool. You know, because there have been so many times in my spiritual life and my life of meditation where it felt like nothing was happening. It was just nothing was happening. Only for me to look back in hindsight to realize, oh wow, something was happening. You know, it was that time was building a foundation. Or even that time really hurt, but it was opening me to greater compassion for what was yet to come, which I couldn't see at the time. Something was happening. And so many times in our efforts to make a difference in this world, to be effective, you know, to make effective change, it feels like nothing's happening. And when we're lucky, we get to look back at hindsight and realize, oh yeah, that was a step, that was a seed, that was a link. And look at how it unfolded. You know, so the Hindsight Meditation Society is my absolute favorite. And then the Insight Meditation Society, we celebrated our 30th anniversary a few years ago, and we designed t-shirts. So I naturally proposed the Hindsight Meditation Society 30 years, which got totally rejected. But somebody had one made for me, and I have one. So I'm quite happy about that. You know, so equanimity is countering. It doesn't mean indifference. It doesn't mean apathy. It doesn't mean we don't care. But it's countering that kind of impatience that need to be in control. That idea that I have to save them now. You know, but that feeling of participating, engaging, contributing, but without such attachment. You know, without such expectation. To be able to let go a little bit. With wisdom. You know, not through not caring, but definitely like the voice of wisdom. So these are the four Brahmaviharas of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And when we do a practice like loving kindness meditation, we're really doing all four. We're cultivating all four of these qualities. There are also certainly ways to do them distinctively as individual practices, but we tend to bring them together. And they are done by consciously changing how we're using our attention. So, one example would be one of the classic categories in loving kindness meditation is offering loving kindness to somebody who's like a neutral person for us. Somebody we don't particularly like or dislike. And this is the kind of person we tend to just look right through. You know, we objectify nearly completely, and once we objectify somebody, they are an object. And therefore there's no resonance, you know, of empathy, of caring. And so we play with our attention. This person whom we normally look right through, we stop. We hold them in our hearts. We wish them well. If we have a tendency, you know, which can also be a sort of cynicism or a highly praised trait sometimes in a society of seeing what's wrong with everyone, you know, and not sort of seeing what's right. then we actually take the time to pay attention to what's right. And just to see what happens. You know, that's my favorite thing to say about loving kindness meditation. It's like, what happens? You know, what happens when I don't carp on that stupid thing I said at lunch and I spend a moment saying, wow, you did that, you know. That was kind of cool. You know, what happens when I am in the checkout line at the supermarket and I actually pay attention to the person who's working there instead of thinking they're sort of part of the store? You know, what happens when I work with opening to someone's sorrow or someone's joy? So what happens? That's why, you know, you can't think of this practice as like militaristic or, you know, I've got to love everybody right away. Or, you know, you also, it's not that helpful to think about it as an emotion. You may not be filled with the feeling as you do this practice, and that's absolutely okay. Because it's about this experiment in attention. To pay more full attention, to open or include, to pay attention that's not so bound with our ideas about someone. So it's almost like a wild experiment, you know, in movement and so on. And may you be happy too, whoever's calling. And so we use, classically in this practice, we use certain phrases as the conduit for our attention. Who's calling? We do this practice both sitting and walking. You can do it lying down. You can do it standing, just like any practice. But I thought the first thing we could do is a walking practice. Oh, you really want to talk to somebody? Yes? That's okay. And so I thought we'd start with walking, which would also get us out walking where it's not raining, and even by Seattle standards. And come back and we'll do a sitting practice of loving kindness, and there'll be some time for questions and so on. So again, there are many, many methods, many forms, many varieties of ways of doing these kinds of practices. So I will offer you one suggestion and you can experiment with that. So when we do loving kindness practice walking, we rest our attention on the silent repetition of certain phrases. That's like that thread. You know, you don't necessarily have to pay attention to the sensations of the movement in this particular style of practice. The thread of attention, like our primary object, is the silent repetition of certain phrases. And it clearly needs to be a light awareness, you know, because you're walking. And you know, you need to be aware of everything going on around you, even as you are saying the phrases. And I will emphasize silently one more time, you know, because I was teaching in Berkeley last year, and either I wasn't clear enough or somebody misunderstood. And she came back into the hall and she said, well, I finally like mustered up all of my courage and walked up to somebody and said, may you be happy. And I thought, well, at least it's Berkeley, you know? It's okay. So it's a silent repetition of certain phrases. When we do walking meditation and loving kindness, you can walk at any speed. And once again, if walking, you know, if you have some physical difficulty or issue with walking, you don't have to do this walking. You know, the idea is that you're in kind of an open sphere of attention. You can be outside. You could be sitting outside, eyes open, you know, if you can get outside, I think it is good, because there's a lot of life out there. But if, you know, it feels more appropriate for whatever reason for you to stay inside, that's fine too. When we are walking and doing loving kindness, you don't have to slow down at all. You could slow down if you wanted to, but you don't have to. So what I suggest is that the phrases primarily be directed toward yourself. And usually we choose, you know, two or three or four phrases. In sitting, it's usually four. And the idea behind the phrases is that it's like offering a gift to yourself, like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. Or classically in sitting, which we'll do in a little while, it's may I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. And this last, may I live with ease, means in the things of day-to-day life, like livelihood and family, may it not be a struggle. May I live with ease. You know, I'll go over these again before we sit. The may I way of phrasing sometimes catches people up. It's not meant to be begging or imploring. As my friend Sylvia Boorstein told me, I'm not going to remember the exact part of speech, but she said it's like handing someone a birthday card and saying, may you have a happy birthday. You know, may I be safe. May you be safe. It's really something that's very open, it's very general. It's big enough so it's like a gift you're offering to yourself and ultimately can offer to others. So in walking, it's two or three or four phrases like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I live with ease of heart, whatever, you know, you choose. Or if you want to use the four, may I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. And I would suggest that your primary object be the offering of phrases to yourself as you're walking along silently. And then if another being comes strongly into your consciousness, someone walks by, you hear a bird, you hear a dog, you see a bug, just include them for a moment, like, oh, be happy. And then go back to the offering of loving kindness to yourself. The reason I suggest doing that, and there are many, many, many ways of doing this, as I said, is just because there's a lot of life out there and it could get really jumbled, like, oh, be happy, be happy, be happy, be happy. You know, so if there's a certain kind of container, this feeling that we're dedicating our attention to the offering of loving kindness to ourselves as a kind of base, and then we include, you know, maybe somebody pops into your mind, you know, very strongly, and you go, oh, be happy. And I find that a very interesting and fun way of practicing because we never know. You know, maybe we're afraid of dogs, and it's a dog sound that we hear. So it's like, oh, be happy. And just to see what happens, you know, as we include and so on. So do you have any questions just about that technique, that method of practice? Okay, so if we could be back by like 5 of 11, that would be really good. Thank you.